I'm Hugh Bennett for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. Our cover story this week, resilience on the menu. Triangle Restaurants push for a path to profitability and success. Before that cover story, we'll go with the biz section and the reporter pages. The biz section is written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Raleigh TV stations weigh space needs. ABC 11 is moving its main anchors from Raleigh back to Durham, and CBS 17 is weighing a move out of its building on Front Street as two of the Triangle's major broadcasters weigh changes. ABC 11 began in Durham, but has increasingly emphasized its presence in Raleigh, especially as Wake County has prospered and exploded. The station opened a high-profile newsroom in Raleigh on Fayetteville Street in 2005. But ABC 11 is creating a new and enhanced studio and production facility in Durham and will concentrate its main anchors there as soon as the end of this year or early next year, Biz has learned. The station will keep the space and use it for reporters and other personnel. But the Raleigh facility and its serving as the home of key anchors is highly symbolic for ABC 11 in many ways. First, it puts its brand squarely in the state capital and in the center of prosperous Wake County, where a population of more than 1.1 million is far larger than Durham County's 325,000. It also puts it not far from arch-rival WRAL, located nearby on Western Boulevard. The Raleigh office was ABC 11's first expansion, and it later followed with a studio on Hay Street in Fayetteville. Also weighing options is CBS 17, which is now located behind the Raleigh Wegmans on Front Street. John Lewis, the station's vice president and general manager, confirmed that the station is reviewing options for a new home, but was just in the early stages of that process. The Spectrum Companies of Charlotte plans a major redevelopment of that part of Midtown Raleigh. That area has seen a surge of development interest in recent years, thanks in part to nearby North Hills. Both ABC 11 and CBS 17 lease their current space in Raleigh. Attendance at the fair comes up just short of 1 million. The days-long stretch of wonderful weather fueled big turnout at the North Carolina State Fair this year, but a dip in temperatures on the final day may have cost it dearly. The fair saw just shy of 999,000 people come through the gates in West Raleigh between October 17th and 27th. It's the closest to 1 million the fair has reached since the last time it topped seven figures in 2017. Attendance was more than 70,000 higher than 2023 and shows a strong appetite remains for fair food and rides when the sun is shining. Growing Sanford adds to water capacity. A regional powerhouse in water and sewer utilities is set to get bigger as more service areas come into the fold. The city of Sanford, along with representatives from the towns of Pittsboro, Fuquay Varina, and Holly Springs, met recently to break ground on a water filtration facility expansion. The $391 million project will increase the facility's treatment capacity from 12 million gallons per day to 30 million gallons per day. This expansion comes as Sanford, which helps supply water to Fuquay Varina and Holly Springs, is taking on new partnerships. The city finalized a utility merger with Pittsboro earlier this year and is in talks to do similar agreements with Chatham County and the western Chatham County town of Siler City. Artists showcased at New Durham Development. Here at Biz, we're all for highlighting art, so good for McKee Homes for spotlighting 25 Durham artists in its new community in Durham called The View. McKee Homes bought pieces from 25 artists to display in its model home. Once The View is finished, McKee Homes will auction off the pieces, with the proceeds going to charities. We're proud to showcase the incredible talent of Durham's artists through the gallery at The View, said Trish Hanchett, president of McKee Homes. Local Alfred Williams leader honored. Congrats are in order for Catherine Thomas, an Alfred Williams & Company executive and experienced leader in the market. Thomas received a Lifetime Service Award recently from the North Carolina Economic Development Association. Thomas is a Meredith College graduate who has had a variety of leadership roles, including with Progress Energy, before serving at Alfred Williams for the past 11 years. Lauren Onasorge writes the Transportation and Development section for the TBJ. Her main story this week, construction delays sting Rollsville businesses. Business owners in Rollsville say delays on a $20 million project to enhance the downtown area are hitting their bottom lines and threatening their future. The project calls for a complete revamp of the area around the intersection of Main and Young Streets by adding sidewalks, lamps, and multimodal options such as bike lanes to create a pedestrian-friendly downtown. But the project, which has closed the intersection, has been wrought with delays and bureaucratic red tape. A portion of Main Street was supposed to reopen in October, but instead all work has been halted due to water lines needing to be replaced. It could be well into 2025 before work restarts. Jenny Sellers, who co-owns Susanna's Antiques with her mother, Susie Foster, says business is down by half from normal revenue. She says the access has been completely ridiculous since the intersection closed in June, a month after the town put barriers in front of her shop. Inadequate detour signage sends potential customers through neighborhoods in a way that, if they're not from Rollsville, will leave them lost, she says. Customers that do find the shop have to park at a local church or a new parking lot. We do not have direct parking, Sellers says. She learned recently at a Rollsville Town Council meeting that the project was being delayed again. This time, work is not going to restart until spring or summer, as the town has to wait on certain approvals from the North Carolina Department of Transportation. Josh Douthat of contractor RK&K told town officials that multiple issues, from permitting issues to the discovery of a fuel tank from an old gas station, have extended the project's timeline. But the biggest issue is a water line that needs to be completely replaced. According to town officials, the project is nearly 56% complete, and 58% of the funds have been spent. The project is not running out of money. We're in a very good position, town manager Eric Marsh told Rollsville commissioners. New bridge planned for heavy traffic location in RTP. A $105 million grant from the U.S. Department of Transportation could get more people on trains from Raleigh to Charlotte, and much of the plan centers on the Triangle. In Durham, the state's match of $34 million will bring a rail bridge taking East Cornwallis Road over the tracks near its intersection with South Miami Boulevard. The NC Railroad Company's grant, which comes through the Consolidated Rail Infrastructure and Safety Improvement Program, combined with contribution pledges from NCRR of $17.8 million, NCDOT $34 million, and Norfolk Southern $13 million, bring the funding to $170 million. Virtually all of NCDOT's match will go toward the Research Triangle Park Bridge. The Cornwallis Bridge project was a priority for NCDOT, according to Jason Orthner, Rail Division Director, making it prime to leverage for federal dollars. Cornwallis Road is a heavily trafficked area, which is why the bridge project is being prioritized. When you separate the roadway from the railroad, that traffic does not have to stop for trains, Orthner says. You're driving economic development and you're driving economic mobility. Air taxi firm beefs up office near RDU. Quietly, a next-generation aircraft manufacturer is building up an office near Raleigh-Durham International Airport with ambitions of electric air taxis someday soaring over the Triangle's rush hour gridlock. Beta Technologies, headquartered in Vermont, has been steadily hiring here for the past few years, attracted in part by the Department of Energy-funded Power America Institute at NC State University. Today, the company has about 40 people working out of a space in Morrisville. The, quote, Flight Control Engineering Center, unquote, is off the Aviation Parkway exit on the north side of Interstate 40. The local engineering team is contributing to the company's prototypes working through the Federal Aviation Administration process. Blaine Newton, Chief Information Officer at Beta, describes Morrisville as a core office for the company as it builds out its technology and said finding talent has been remarkably smooth. Beta is also building out a 3,200-square-foot hangar space at Raleigh Executive Jetport in Sanford, where it has installed electric aviation chargers on and off the airfield. Its EV charger at Raleigh Executive Jetport is the first Level 3 aerospace charger in the state. Turning now to retail and restaurants, Kate Tracy tells us all about that subject. Al's Burger Shack adds prime land. The owners of a popular burger joint in Chapel Hill now have their own real estate on Franklin Street. Excuse me. An LLC affiliated with Al's Burger Shack purchased the properties at 516 West Franklin Street, which holds Burger Shack and 104 North Graham Street, for $1.2 million combined, according to Orange County records. The Graham site is home to Quantum Soul, a gift shop and center for tarot readings, witchcraft workshops, and more. It's directly behind Al's flagship 678-square-foot location. The two buildings share outdoor space and tables for the restaurant's guests. Charlie Ferris, co-owner of Al's Burger Shop, says that Quantum Soul is welcome to stay on as tenants at 104 North Graham Street for as long as the owners want. If Quantum Soul moves out, Ferris says they will either expand with more indoor seating, storage, and bar, or market it for lease. Right now, we're just so excited to own that little corner of Franklin Street. I graduated from UNC in 2004, so it's just really, really cool to own a spot on Franklin, Ferris says in an email. The LLC behind the Quantum Soul building is based in Chapel Hill and managed by Sidney Martin. At one point, a Top Chef alum and his sister were working on opening an Italian restaurant called Bombolo in the building, but the restaurant never opened. The real estate purchase comes nearly 2 years after Al's Burger Shop came under new ownership. Founder Al Bauer sold the business to Ferris and Jason Kelser at the end of 2022. Prior to the sale, Al's Burger Shop earned its fair share of national recognition. It also survived bankruptcy. Kessler and Ferris are both UNC Chapel Hill graduates and Jersey Mike's franchise owners. Under their ownership, Al's Burger Shack has been in expansion mode. The business signed a lease for space in the Sweetwater Town Center in Apex. It also has a coming soon address in Leland on its website. South Hills transformation takes key step. 3 years after spending millions to buy a mall in Cary, developers have cleared an important hurdle. The Cary Town Council on October 22nd unanimously approved the rezoning for South Hills Mall. Loden Properties and North Pond Partners of Chicago make up the project's development team. The timeline for the 44.35-acre development will span 10 to 15 years, with construction starting late next year. In addition to 1,755 residential units and 350 hotel rooms, plans include 935,000 square feet of office space, 550,000 square feet of retail and commercial space, 328,000 square feet for a community and sports recreation center, and 235,000 square feet for research and lab space. Loden and North Pond purchased the site in 2021 for $38.4 million and submitted a rezoning application in 2023. A referendum on the ballot in Cary would provide funding for the sports complex. Fitness studios file for bankruptcy. Three North Carolina locations for gym club Fuel Fitness have landed in Chapter 11 bankruptcy. The impacted locations are in Mooresville, Durham, and Winston-Salem, but will remain open. The company also has gyms in Wilmington and Wilson that are not included in the bankruptcy filing. Christopher Stewart, CEO of Fuel Fitness Holdings, said the decision to file for bankruptcy stemmed from a failed partnership that was meant to fund new locations. We believe that this restructuring process will allow Fuel Fitness Holdings to emerge stronger and more resilient. Stewart is the former chief operating officer at O2 Fitness. On Glenwood Avenue, a new Raleigh boutique will have focus on wellness. Amy Parker Cook is ensuring that mental health is top of mind at her new store in Northwest Raleigh. A CPA by profession, Parker Cook is opening a mental wellness boutique called Petal and Pink at 4800 Grove Barton Road near Target and the Cinemark Theater off Glenwood Avenue. Parker Cook liked the 1,400 square foot space because of its proximity to other businesses and for being in a high traffic area. A psychology major in college, Parker Cook later became a CPA and has practiced as an accountant for the past 20 years, first at the firm Thomas, Judy, and Tucker, and then later starting her own business. She'll remain working as a CPA while operating Petal and Pink. After a lifelong struggle with anxiety, Parker Cook started going to mental health counseling during the pandemic. Her aim in opening Petal and Pink is to provide customers with items that will help help keep them on the right mental track between therapy sessions. There are a lot of places that carry one or two mental health-themed items, but not the variety that we're hoping to carry, she says. She's hired five employees to help run Peddlin' Pink. She's also invested approximately $40,000 of her own funds to get the store up and running. Zach Ezone is here to tell us about the happenings in the healthcare and life sciences world. His top story this week, NC State's Angel Network gives Jolt. A medical technology startup has brought in additional capital through an investment from NC State University's Angel Investing platform. Wolfpack Investor Network and Harbright Ventures have raised $1.75 million in a follow-on investment for Sonovascular, a local startup focused on developing medical devices for treating vascular disease. The startup is currently advancing its sonothrombectomy system, recently initiating its first clinical trials for patients with venous thromboembolism. The first patient was treated in August at a hospital in Chile, and four additional patients have been treated since. The recent investment will help the company accelerate the development of its technology to help it reach patients needing safer and more effective treatment options for venous thromboembolism, said Daniel Estay, E-S-T-A-Y, company founder and CEO. Sonovascular was formed around technology developed within the Joint Department of Medical Engineering at UNC Chapel Hill and NC State. Estay, in 2018, signed a license agreement to take the technology out of NC State and formed a company to carry it forward. Prior to this recent funding, the startup had raised about $5 million from early supporters, such as Carolina Research Ventures and the Wolfpack Investor Network. The Wolfpack Investor Network launched in December 2016 and has since grown to 36 portfolio companies that span various industries, including textiles, agriculture, software, and medical technology, like Sonovascular. The network has invested more than $25 million, mostly in initial rounds, said Abby Phillips, director of the network. Phillips has been involved with the network since January 2017 and became director this year, but Phillips' role really changed about 2 years ago when she became the point person for the partnership with Harbright Ventures. Because of its connection with a public university, the network has limitations on some activities. Meanwhile, Harbright, as a partner, can lead deals and have more of an active role with companies following an investment. Biotech hits milestone with hepatitis drug. A gene editing company in Durham has taken a major step in its efforts to develop a cure for hepatitis B. Precision Biosciences has received approval to advance a gene editing program wholly owned by the company into the clinic for the first time. Regulators in Moldova recently approved the company's clinical trial application to evaluate a gene editing program targeting chronic hepatitis B, which affects millions of patients around the world. The clinical trial approval is a major milestone for Precision, which last year made a strategic pivot to exit its cell therapy efforts. Chief Financial Officer Alex Kelly says those deals allowed the company to focus on its gene editing programs. The company is also filing additional applications in other countries as part of its Phase 1 regulatory strategy for the program called PBGene-HBV. Our goal, really, by going to multiple sites is to allow us to enroll the trial as quickly as we can and to get the data readouts, Kelly says. Durham Biotech raises $175 million for oncology drugs. A biotechnology firm with operations in Durham has closed a major funding round. Actis Oncology, which is headquartered in Boston but has a significant presence here, recently closed what it describes as an oversubscribed and upsized $175 million Series B financing round. The financing was led by RA Capital Management and co-led by RTW Investments and Janus Henderson Investors. Actis said all existing institutional investors also participated, as did strategic investors Bristol Myers Squibb, Eli Lilly, and MRL Ventures Fund, the therapeutics-focused corporate venture fund of Merck & Company. Actis now has more than $300 million in cash. And finally, layoffs hit Raleigh Pharma Company. A drug developer is cutting more than a dozen employees in Raleigh as part of a broad restructuring following recent clinical trial setbacks. Sage Therapeutics, which is headquartered near Boston, recently disclosed plans for a strategic reorganization that will eliminate about one-third of its workforce and more than half of its company's research and development team. In a notice filed with the NC Department of Commerce, Sage says it is terminating a total of 169 employees, including 14 in North Carolina. Sage operates a patient support center on Briar Creek Parkway in Raleigh. According to its latest quarterly earnings report, the company has an operating lease for 15,525 square feet of space in Raleigh that expires November 30th. Sage does not plan to renew its lease, the company spokesperson says. The company on October 17th disclosed its restructuring plans. Earlier this month, Sage announced that a Phase 2 study evaluating its experimental drug Delzanemdor in patients with mild cognitive impairment or mild dementia due to Alzheimer's disease failed to meet its goals. In April, the company shut down a Phase 2 trial evaluating the same drug in Parkinson's disease after it also missed its target. Happenings in the Greater Triangle area are the purview of staff writer Ben Tobin. TriPoint adds lots in Serenity. A national home builder is getting in on one of the busiest housing projects in the Triangle. TriPoint Homes of California spent more than $8.5 million recently to acquire 65 lots in the Serenity development in Fuquay Varina, northwest of the intersection of Highway 401 and Rawls Church Road, according to Harnett County deed records. Spearheaded by Raleigh developer Greenfield Communities, Serenity is a 550-acre community that will have a roughly 1,200 homes at full build-out. Amanda Hoyle, director of land acquisition for TriPoint, says that the purchase represents the first 65 lots for the home builder's Altus project. Announced this past summer, Altus will be the first 55-plus lifestyle brand community for TriPoint on the East Coast. Homes in the brand will range from 1,280 square feet to more than 2,600 square feet and will be priced from the 400,000s. All homes will be ranch-style, single-family homes with the primary bedroom and bathroom on the main level. We have contracted with the developer to buy the Altus lots in phases through spring 2029 as those future phase lots are completed, Hoyle says. In total, Altus will have about 425 housing lots. We expect to begin construction of the first houses there by January or February. This marks yet another home builder jumping into the Serenity development, which is one of the hottest housing projects in the Triangle area. Other home builders involved in the project include David Weekly Homes, Dries Homes, Garmin Homes, ICG Homes, and others. The Serenity project will cover 550 acres and eventually feature nearly 1,200 homes. The development will surely bolster Harnett County's already booming population. Harnett's population ballooned from 114,678 in 2010 to 141,477 in 2023, according to estimates from the U.S. Census Bureau. In Franklin County, homes under 400,000 are planned north of Raleigh. The Triangle's fastest-growing county isn't going to stop attracting new residents anytime soon. Home builders will make sure of that. In the latest example of a new subdivision in Franklin County, Mungo Homes, a subsidiary of Tennessee's Clayton Properties Group, is planning a 36-lot subdivision off Mount Olivet Church Road. Clayton Properties Group purchased the lots with Franklinton addresses for $3.6 million earlier this month, according to Franklin County deed records. Per the home builder's website, the subdivision called Olivet will start selling homes in the upper 300,000s. Available floor plans listed on the website range from 2,218 to 2,833 square feet. These days, anything under 400,000 in the Triangle is considered a bargain for home buyers, especially as mortgage rates remain above 6%. In Johnston County, auto shop sells for well above $1 million. A collision repair shop in one of North Carolina's fastest-growing counties has sold for well above $1 million. Alpha Omega Advisement, a Wilson-based group tied to Jason Zander, franchise owner of several CarStar auto body shops in North Carolina, purchased roughly 5 acres at 20 East Malibu Drive on the Johnston County side of Garner for $1.8 million last month, according to Johnston County deed records. The seller is Triple B number 29 ODS, a Greenville-based LLC tied to Brody Co., a real estate developer. The address is home to CarStar Auto Body of Cleveland. Johnston County's population boom has led to a constant string of commercial investments. The county's population was nearly 242,000 in July of last year, a more than 42% jump from 2010. And finally, in Lee County, South Carolina firm buys Sanford Land. A large housing development in Sanford is moving forward after a major land acquisition. An LLC tied to Contender Development of South Carolina purchased roughly 85 acres at 3311 Lee Avenue for more than $6.2 million last month, according to Lee County deed records. The land is southeast of downtown Sanford and will be part of the Adams Village Project. The move marks a significant step forward for the project, which received rezoning approval by the Sanford City Council in February to shift the zoning from residential single-family, restricted residential, and light industrial to a conditional zoning district. Josh Howard, president of Contender Development, previously called Adams Village another great investment in Sanford, and said the company is committed to the vision of Sanford and the surrounding area and excited for the future. The housing project will have up to 295 units, with 211 single-family detached homes and 84 townhomes. The project was originally spearheaded by local developer Ray Covington, with an LLC attached to Covington selling the land to Contender Development. Meanwhile, Contender Development has been active in the Triangle. Earlier this year, the developer purchased roughly 38 acres off Fleming Road in Youngsville for roughly $5.5 million. Let's turn now to the cover story. Endurance tests. Triangle restaurants show resilience as costs and challenges rise. Kate Tracy's the author of this story. Triangle restaurateur Kevin Jennings couldn't restrain himself after a Yelp reviewer dropped a one-star bomb on one of his restaurant pages in February. The reviewer complained that Jennings' Avelina restaurant had canceled a reservation last minute. Little did the reviewer know that Avelina had just closed for good. "We lost thousands and thousands of dollars trying to stay open after COVID," Jennings retorted online to the Yelp review. "Cry me a river about your dinner reservations." Jennings' urban food group, whose restaurants include the popular Vivace and Coquette in Raleigh, had high hopes when it expanded to Denver, but the tough market conditions for restaurants forced Jennings to close Avelina in February. 7 months later, Jennings is more measured, but he acknowledges guests don't always understand the tough realities for operating restaurants in 2024. Some of the Triangle's most successful restaurant owners, including Jennings, Scott Crawford, Preeti Waz, and Amber Moshikos, say just about every aspect of running one costs more. Labor, food, utilities, rent, linens, and more. Combined with playing catch-up from the pandemic, the environment has made it difficult to stay profitable while pleasing guests. And yet, Triangle restaurant owners are finding ways to survive and even thrive. Urban Food Group finds a path. Jennings calls his wife Stacy, who runs Urban Food Group with him, a financial genius. "That's the only reason, really, we're in business," he says. To survive, Urban Food Group has had to cull its restaurant herd. In Denver, Avelina was making $60,000 per week before the pandemic and then dropped to half that. In Charlotte, Bar Marcel pulled in $55,000 per week before the pandemic. "We were crushing it," Jennings says. After the pandemic, he says, it was like we never existed. But Marcel dropped to $30,000 per week. Urban Food Group sold Bar Marcel in an asset sale last year. In another asset sale, the group sold a South Charlotte restaurant that went from $35,000 a week before the pandemic to $12,000 post-pandemic. Jennings said many of his other venues, Vivace, Coquette, Chow, Osteria, Schicchetti, and Brasserie du Soleil, for example, have done well. "I'm not going to sit here and cry the sob story, but we lost a bunch of money in having to sell those restaurants," he says, "and we were also making more money in these restaurants." Urban Food Group has been profitable every year since 2020, but Jennings says that profit margin has dropped by at least 50% since the pandemic. While the business received Paycheck Protection Program loans, he declined to take on Small Business Administration or other loans, something that has been a thorn in the side of other Triangle businesses. Still, the group has yet to match its 2019 revenue of $23 million. With 4 months to go in 2024, Urban Food Group's revenue was $11 million. Vivace in North Hills is its most profitable restaurant. The 3,900-square-foot space costs approximately $20,000 in monthly rent, with at least 5 years left on its lease. Rising food costs have been a significant challenge. Vivace has a steak on its menu for $49. Jennings says that steak cost $22 for the restaurant to buy. Normally, the restaurant markup would be much higher, he says. I can't sell that steak for $90-something dollars, so I don't do it, right? Some things, they just can't be that expensive. No one's going to buy it, Jennings says. Salaries are up. At the start of the pandemic, Jennings laid off approximately 400 staff members. Now the business has approximately 280 employees at its restaurants. Even with the minimum wage of $7.25 per hour, Urban Food Group pays its dishwashers and line cooks between $18 and $20 per hour at some of its restaurants. If inflation has smacked restaurant owners hard, it's hit their guests hard as well. Recently, the Jennings's were enjoying a meal at Coquette, and Kevin Jennings noticed guests at multiple tables only ordering one appetizer to share and one drink each. Prior to the pandemic, Jennings never noticed these light orders for multiple tables at the same time. His restaurant sales reflect the decreased amount guests are ordering. Coquette is down 7 or 8% year over year, while Vivace is down 5 or 6%. My profit is receding and we're charging more, Jennings says. All I can do is whatever I think is best to get us to whatever the other side is, if there is another side. Even Jennings himself is flabbergasted at the cost of eating out in Raleigh, which makes it all the more important to deliver a great experience for guests. When they walk out the door, they're going to be like, yes, it was $40 a person, but that was damn good. There's value in having things be good, Jennings says. He's noticed other shifts, such as late-night dining, no longer existing. If we have people coming in after 8:30, we're shocked, Jennings says. Amber Moshikos, president at LM Restaurants in Raleigh, also has concerns when it comes to labor. Not only is she paying more for her hourly workers, she's also paying more for inexperienced workers. She says many legacy workers in food and beverage left after the pandemic hit and never came back. Now LM is in a situation where less productive kitchen workers are making significantly higher hourly wages, and they lack the finesse that years of working in the kitchen brings. When you watch somebody who is experienced in the industry, they move like a professional athlete, she says. Now it's a different story. What used to take one person is now taking two people because they don't know basic skills, Moshiko says. With the experienced kitchen staff gone, there's also a severe lack of mentorship and training that used to take place naturally. I had one chef lamenting the other day to me, I've got cooks who don't know the difference between a tablespoon and a teaspoon, she says. For Moshiko's, finding and retaining employees has been the most painful part of pandemic recovery. With supply chain issues or inflation, it's easy enough to pare down menus from 40 items to 30 or make other changes as necessary. You can't plug and play humans, she says. Moshiko's has tried to get creative. LM started to hire gig employees, just like hiring an Uber driver. The restaurant company used an online platform to hire certified dishwashers or line workers to work shift by shift. However, it was too expensive with the platform fees, so LM hasn't hired that way for 18 months. Even with these setbacks, LM just opened high-profile Birdie's Barroom and Kitchen in downtown Raleigh, a partnership between LM and landlord Highwoods Properties. We believe in Raleigh. More importantly, we believe in the downtown, that it will recover, and with the right leadership and the right visionary leaders, we think it's only a matter of time that it will come back. Will it look the same? No. But will it come back? Yes, Moshiko says. Despite hiring challenges, she says hiring for Birdie's went well, and growth is not slowing down as the restaurant group, which owns the Carolina Ale House chain, has five locations in the works. Raleigh restaurateur Scott Crawford called 2020 the hardest, most emotional, uncertain year I think I've ever had in my career. Instead of panicking, he planned. For the sake of his own sanity, he let his imagination run wild as he envisioned future venues for after the nightmare was over. But it wasn't just mindless daydreaming. He created detailed strategies for his future restaurants. I had time to develop those business plans and the financials for those, so when 2021 came around, I started having conversations with developers, and I signed deals when no one else was signing anything, Crawford says. Crawford still operated his restaurants, Crawford and Son and Jolie, and 2020 didn't make it easy. I had moments where I thought, wow, I don't know how we're going to make it through this, he says, but then I just didn't allow myself a whole lot of time to think that way, because I'm big into manifesting your own success. Developing a successful to-go menu for his restaurants made a huge difference. Crawford says his restaurants made $1 million just from curbside revenue in 2020. We did it extremely well, he says. The fruit of his labor has ripened this year. He has or is opening 4 new locations in 2024. Brodetto, Crawford's Genuine at the airport, Crawford Brothers Steakhouse, and Sue Terre. To fund this growth, Crawford took advantage of the low 2021 interest rates. He landed 2 separate SBA loans for a total of nearly $3 million. Still, he notes, it's like we're chasing an economy that's impossible. We didn't create any of this. We're just trying to navigate it. But the pressure is on us from both the consumer and the worker, he says. The problem with inflation, Crawford says, hasn't been from luxury food items, but rather the day-to-day staples. If you're a good chef, you don't have to have Wagyu beef on your menu for the menu to be exciting, Crawford says. The problem is butter, cream, oil, the things that you cannot cook without. Salt, the basic staples doubled, tripled, and quadrupled in price. I am always in sticker shock, he says. Crawford believes his restaurant's longevity and reputation help. Our brand and the way that we have nourished people through the pandemic. We were established in the community. I think that's where that kicks in. And it allows us to charge more, and then in turn we make our margin, but yet we can pay our workers more, he says. Entry-level dishwashers make $15 to $18 at his restaurants, but he's quick to point out his business offers more than just an hourly wage. 8 years ago, one of Crawford's workers started as a dishwasher making $12 per hour. He's now a sous chef and next in line to become chef de cuisine. Those growth opportunities, Crawford says, are what attracts true talent. He declines to disclose detailed financials at his restaurants, but says they've been profitable every year since the pandemic. Through 8 years of operation, Crawford says he's seen a profit margin between 10 and 20%, apart from a few short-lived dips. He says he has yet to pay himself from Brodetto, which opened 6 months ago. Crawford Brothers Steakhouse will open either at the end of November or beginning of December. My approach in my career was to work for the best people that I can possibly work for, and the money will follow, and then do the best work you can possibly do, and the money will follow, he says. And that's how it's worked for me. I haven't chased money. Money chases up. Like her peers, Preeti Wass has been feeling the squeeze at her Indian restaurant, Chini. While a lot of common ingredients can be less expensive for Indian cuisine, my labor is higher because we make everything from scratch, Wass says. She pays her front-of-house worker $16 an hour plus tips, something she's proud to offer. Back-of-house staff starts at $19 per hour plus a tip share. At the same time, she's buying high-quality spices from Spice Fix and Proteins, Choice Farms Chicken, Heritage Pork and Lamb from New Zealand. I'm not compromising on our food quality, and so, yes, I'm absolutely paying for it, she says. 1 year since Chini opened in Durham, the restaurant is not yet profitable. Since early 2022, Wass has raised her menu prices at least 4 times. Revenue from her restaurants in 2023 was $737,400, with her Durham Chini location only open for 2 months. I need about 25% more volume, consistent volume of business to get profitable. Her plans for a restaurant at Hub RTP come on the heels of a difficult situation after Wass closed Chini Indian Food Emporium in Raleigh in April. Since then, she's been in a contentious legal battle with her former landlords at the North Raleigh location, where she says she poured thousands into tenant improvements. I refinanced our house to do that. It was very personal, and I had to walk away from that, she says. That's a hard pill to swallow. In the wake of increased prices, many of her customers understand how difficult Wass has it, and she's grateful for their support. At the same time, customers expect more if they're paying higher prices. At an Indian restaurant, that manifests in guests wanting freebies. Free chutney, free papadum, which is a lentil cracker, or free yogurt sauce. I don't understand why we're expected to absorb everything, she says. A member of the Independent Restaurant Coalition, Wass, recently visited Washington, D.C. to advocate for the passage of bills that would help alleviate some of that squeeze on us independent restaurants. High commissions from delivery apps such as DoorDash and Uber Eats, in addition to credit card fees, are major contributors to that squeeze. Something doesn't add up, she says, and yet we're the ones who are supposed to have hospitality to the nth degree and serve with a smile and have the highest quality product and best trained servers. We're supposed to provide it all. Who's providing anything for us? And now for something completely different, we'll go to the 52 Shades of Success, the impact of AI. Emergency efforts get support from AI. Artificial intelligence is making an impact on recovery efforts in Western North Carolina, but fake information is a challenge. Connie Gentry is the writer of this article. As he talks about emergency rescue and recovery operations in the aftermath of Hurricane Helene, Greg Hauser, statewide interoperability coordinator and communications branch manager with North Carolina Emergency Management, stresses how much technology is impacting the efforts. Technology has changed the way that society reacts to these disasters, he says. As the disaster unfolded across Western North Carolina, technology and the growth of artificial intelligence have produced both positive and negative outcomes. The Army's 18th Airborne Corps, headquartered at Fort Liberty, reported it had implemented a decision-making tool that uses artificial intelligence and machine learning to help identify road closures, cellular outages, and where to send medical supplies, resources, and emergency responders. According to the Military Times, this was the first time the battlefield technology was deployed in a hurricane response. On the detrimental side, the viral spread of false information across social media, driven largely by AI-generated images with no foundation in reality, manipulated public perception of the emergency response in the mountains. And rumors ran rampant surrounding the Federal Emergency Management Agency from allocations that FEMA had left the region following threats, which is untrue. FEMA temporarily replaced door-to-door visits with neighborhood centers to ensure the safety of staff and people being helped, but FEMA support has continued unabated. To a rumor based on long-standing conspiracy theories that FEMA camps were established to detain people and diminish aid for survivors. Reality transcends rumors. As of October 22nd, a FEMA spokesperson confirmed they have deployed more than 4,900 personnel to affected areas in Western North Carolina, part of the total 7,000-plus federal responders. While we are not using AI in this event, FEMA programs are taking the initiative to explore AI use cases with initial custom-built models and commercial off-the-shelf solutions, FEMA replied in an email. Earlier this year, FEMA launched a pilot program utilizing generative AI to help communities develop compliant hazard mitigation plans. Given his vantage point, Hauser considers the technology conundrum from a pragmatic perspective. What happens when technology fails? He leads emergency support functions for first responder communications, ensures 911 calls are being answered, and makes sure the public can access internet, cellular service, and the broadcast infrastructure. The interoperability piece of my job is to prepare our communications people for North Carolina's worst day, and we had our worst day, Hauser says. But even after 911 networks in the impacted area started to degrade, emergency responders could still communicate. We have a land mobile radio network, and our statewide radio network never went down, he says. First responders were able to communicate, and 911 centers were able to talk to other 911 centers. In Western North Carolina, 19 public safety answering points, PSAPs, rerouted 911 calls to 23 partner PSAPs in other parts of the state. The North Carolina 911 Board oversees 124 PSAPs, and Pokey Harris, executive director of the 911 Board, says more than $80 million annual funds those PSAPs. From September 26th through September 28th, 911 telecommunications answered nearly 90,000 calls, a 55% year-over-year increase in call volume. Reinforcing the scale of the event, Hauser says, we've had 24 communications professionals at the regional center in Hickory dealing with technological issues, working with commercial carriers to get internet back, and coordinating the response. In a normal hurricane, we might have 8 people in place, so Helene was triple that. This was a throw-the-handle event. Everybody we have from across the state is gone, and we called in teams from Florida, Alabama, and Connecticut. Ironically, Hauser's group had conducted a training exercise within the last year in the Morganton-Hickory area. They assembled teams from across the state and beyond, including folks from Alabama's Emergency Management Department, to game play this specific kind of event where areas suddenly have no communication. All of the teams that attended that training responded to the current disaster, and drone technology is a prime example of how that training is being put into action now. Drones can have heat sensing technology that is very beneficial in devastated areas, and our specialized teams can utilize that drone data to come up with a plan to help folks on the ground, he says. Increasingly, the thermal technology on drones that identify body heat are integrating AI algorithms to identify human forms. However, as a general rule, adoption of AI is still in the planning and discussing phase. There has been a hesitation to move to artificial intelligence among public safety leaders, Hauser says. We're constantly worried about cyber intrusions or people wishing us harm, where we kind of miss the opportunity to use AI beneficially. But we have to start having the conversation in public safety for how we're going to use AI to move us forward. After studying the use of AI for emergency management and crisis response, the Deloitte Center for Government Insights concluded the intersection of AI opportunity and emergency preparedness and response imperatives creates a pivotal moment for leaders. And in April, the Deloitte Center released survey results that reported 56% of leaders in the public sector, including local, state, and federal government, said generative AI will drive transformational change in their organization within the coming year. Harris says none of the PSAP centers funded by the 911 board are using AI to process 911 calls, but adds there's a lot of talk in the 911 space across the country about utilization of AI for call processing, and a handful are using AI for the administrative 10-digit calls that come in. She knows of one North Carolina county that had just begun implementing AI in August for administrative 10-digit calls to its 911 center. Coincidentally, it's Buncombe County, home to Asheville, Swannanoa, Black Mountain, and other hard-hit disaster areas. There are additional 911 call centers in the state beyond the 124 PSAPs operating under the 911 board, and some may have begun utilizing AI. For instance, the town of Cary began testing an AI-driven automation system to assist with 911 calls this summer. In a statement from Rapid SOS, developer of the alarm call automation, Doug Workman, Emergency Communications Center Manager at Cary's 911 center, said, "By reducing the time spent on manual call handling, dispatchers can focus more on high-priority tasks and direct resources more effectively." The business case for utilizing AI, particularly in public safety and among 911 dispatchers, is to address some of the workforce challenges these agencies have faced. "At this point, I'm advocating for the use of AI with administrative call processing for our 911 network," says Harris, emphasizing the goal is to improve efficiencies, not eliminate jobs. And in fact, it would behoove any local government entity to look at utilizing AI for administrative calls across many of their departments and agencies. This week's Executive Voice features Mary Hobbs, the president of Hobbs Properties Incorporated. Raleigh's Hobbs Properties has grown a family legacy into a real estate services business that now owns, operates, leases, or manages over 630,000 square feet across 21 properties in the Triangle. The company was founded in 1995, but can trace its roots back to 1957, when Douglas Hobbs, the father of its founder, Greg Hobbs, amassed a few small Raleigh real estate holdings, including some apartments and a dance studio. After college, Greg Hobbs moved to Houston and leased office buildings downtown, but his father convinced him that Raleigh was the place to be. "We would chuckle when periodically certain news clippings found their way to our mailbox from, quote, an anonymous source, but we were not surprised that so many publications touted Raleigh as the best place to live and do business," says Mary Hobbs, the company's president. Eventually, Douglas Hobbs asked his son to help build office buildings, and in 1995, Greg and Mary decided to move to Raleigh and start Hobbs Properties. The company employs 15 and offers leasing, management, construction, and development services. Greg Hobbs ran the business until his death last October. His wife Mary had been involved in managing the finances since the beginning, but primarily served as a sounding board and advisor before taking over. Cameron Snipes of the TBJ asked her, "How has the transition gone?" "Honestly, the transition has been smooth thanks to our incredible team, most of whom have worked for Hobbs for many years. We've always had a special camaraderie, and Greg's passing has brought us together even stronger. I have witnessed our employees rising to greater heights in terms of their versatility and work ethics. They persevere until the job is complete and done well, and I'm so proud of them. What are areas for growth? We have two areas targeted for growth in the next year. We hope to increase both property management and brokerage services. We have positioned this growth by streamlining our property management capabilities and accounting practices and have recently doubled our brokerage team. We hope to add two brokers by second quarter 2025. Our accounting software has been upgraded, and our accounting staff has the skill set and training needed to provide our customers with timely and excellent financial information. We have a seasoned and highly capable maintenance team and established relationships with the trades we call on for help, so we're ready to go. What are your goals for the firm? Some of our short to intermediate term goals include moving forward on a couple of land development projects and increasing our brokerage and property management footprint. Our primary goal is to strengthen relationships with our wonderful tenants and customers and to maintain Greg's vision of a family business that people respect and want to work with because we are honest and fair. What has been your greatest challenge? My new role as president has been a challenge as I want to honor Greg and his legacy but still have a lot to learn. I'm very grateful that our staff has the tenure and therefore the knowledge to help me flatten the learning curve. What's been your greatest professional triumph? Greg had always wanted me to come to the Monday morning meetings at the office, which I could not have been less interested in, and now I cannot wait to attend. What's the best advice you've received? My dad used to sing this Nat King Cole song to me, especially these lyrics. Nothing's impossible, I have found, for when my chin is on the ground, I pick myself up, dust myself off, and start all over again. We have time left for a few miscellaneous stories. Luring Chinese firms is a balancing act. North Carolina has major investments from companies based in China. Lauren Onasorge wrote this article. Leveling the playing field and protecting U.S. interests, it's why top officials say the scrutiny is increasing when it comes to investments from China. Don Graves, U.S. Deputy Secretary of Commerce, speaking this month after his team announced $750 million in grants targeted to help Durham semiconductor manufacturer Wolfspeed build out its mega factory in Chatham County, said it's no surprise that companies want to come here, but we have to protect our national security at the same time. Chinese officials recently spoke out against recent trade restrictions in the U.S. and the European Union, claiming they violate World Trade Organization rules. Some have said that the pressure the West is putting on Chinese tech firms is destabilizing the global supply chain, which goes against the interests of the U.S. and other nations. But does making it harder for Chinese firms to expand in North Carolina cost the state jobs? Since 2014, 45 Chinese firms have announced expansions in North Carolina, creating more than 4,200 new jobs at nearly $1.4 billion in capital investment. Today, nearly 60 Chinese firms, including Lenovo and Carson Therapeutics, operate in North Carolina. Lenovo is a major employer in the Triangle's thriving tech scene with around 4,000 employees here, according to Triangle Business Journal research. Chinese companies make a lot of announcements, but they tend to create less jobs than those of other Asian countries. While China is second after Japan, which has very strong economic ties to North Carolina in terms of projects announcements, those projects have created less jobs than those coming out of Japan, Vietnam, and India. Officials say it's a balancing they may not want to lose, particularly in North Carolina, where China is one of the top countries of origin for foreign firms interested in creating a U.S. footprint. Christopher Chung, CEO of the Economic Development Partnership of North Carolina, said that new investments by Chinese companies are subjected to more scrutiny than they were 5 years ago amidst a more frayed U.S.-China relationship. The scrutiny has been particularly challenging for local communities as they grapple to find a balance between luring new jobs and geopolitical concerns. It has become very complex to deal with Chinese investment in this state, says Ernest Pearson, a site selection attorney with Maynard Nexen. More homes planned for Northeast Raleigh. More than 1,000 residential units are on the way to a growing area of Raleigh after a recent land sale. Meritage Homes of the Carolinas paid $29 million for 93 acres in Northeast Raleigh to build 641 homes. The land is south of Interstate 540 along Buffalo Road and east of the Neuse River. Phoenix-based developer Suncrest sold the acreage to Meritage after acquiring all 212 acres in 2022 for $12 million. The sale comes to about $311,000 per acre. The purchase is for 641 permitted lots in the new master plan community Buffalo Reserve. Suncrest developed the property with plans to have the remaining 18 acres used for the multifamily portion. Suncrest will either develop the apartments in the next 2 years or sell the 18 acres. Sales soar for firm after Shark Tank. A sales rep turned entrepreneur scored a $350,000 investment pledge for her seafood startup on the hit show Shark Tank. Danielle Mann, CEO and founder of Topsail Steamer, won a deal, now in the due diligence process, from Raising Cane's CEO Todd Graves and serial investor Lori Greiner. Her appearance led to a 500% increase in orders for the Topsail company. For years, the New Jersey native was in pharma equipment sales in the Triangle, but she was at a restaurant serving seafood boils when she saw the pots and thought that could be a business. She opened her first store in 2017 and told Shark Tank she did $4.5 million in sales last year. From Triangle Public Records, in the last week, there were 6 bankruptcies, 92 building permits, 0 federal tax liens, 12 judgments, 8 mechanics liens, 164 new businesses were filed for, 11 commercial real estate transactions, and 0 state tax liens. The bankruptcies were up 5 and the building permits were up 19. We've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Hugh Bennett, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Business Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.